Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Phil Dobby, and today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen, for all Karl Marx's talk about a revolution, and there are Marxists still waiting for that time, well, there hasn't really been one, has there? Revolutions that have happened weren't really as Marx prescribed, but maybe what he advocated for has changed anyway. But could we be engineering a situation where a Marxist-style revolution could be on the cards anyway? Not that we advocate revolutions, of course, because as the Beatles sang all those years ago, when it comes to destruction, don't you know you can count me out? Besides, everything's going to be all right. Is it? That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast. So Marx believed that the power play between the capitalists and the workers would create a class conflict that would ultimately end in a revolution. So, Steve, I mean, the inevitable revolution, wasn't it? Because the bourgeois were making money off the surplus labor of the workers, and people would see the injustice in that. In fact, in the last paragraph of the manifesto of the Communist Party, he wrote, "Let the ruling classes tremble at a communist revolution. The proletariats have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win." Now, to an extent, we had that, didn't we? Because we had the union movement. But it was decried by many, and of course, it's basically died in this country. The revolution we've seen, if anything, has actually been in the bourgeois, the capitalists having even more influence in a position to take even more of that surplus labor, if indeed that is the problem. But also, of course, they're making money out of having money as well. So the revolution has not happened in terms of the workers rising. The revolution has happened in terms of the rich basically making themselves richer.
Well, I mean, I always try to put Marx in the context of what it would have been like to be in England in the 1840s to 1860s. Which is when he did most of his writing. 1844 is when he started getting into economics, and that was in Paris. And not long after that, he was evicted from France. He says he's evicted from Prussia, and ended up in the UK, where the libertarian, in that sense, the liberal politics of the UK relative to Prussia, which was quite proto-fascist in some ways, and France, which was remnants of Napoleon. He got a chance to practice uninhibited for all that time. But what was it like at the time? Well, one thing that that Marx and Jenny did Karl Marx and Jenny Marx did at some stage was move out of Chelsea because of a cholera epidemic. Mm. Now, I know things aren't particularly sanitary there at the moment, most of the best of times, but you don't get cholera anymore. So if you want to think about...
No, certainly not in Chelsea.
Not in Chelsea, no. Yeah. Thank God they got to those nasty Marxes. They probably improved everything. It was fundamentally, my picture of England then would be like India 30 or 40 years ago. And you read the book A Suitable Boy, walking through vast areas where tanning is occurring and the chemicals of tanning are being breathed by people who are working in the tanning factories and often sleeping there. The conditions were absolutely appalling. And what Marx saw as a revolution was getting away from that. But he also, a large part of what he saw as a revolution, we'd call the welfare state these days. It was, universal education, universal health care, et cetera, et cetera.
And even we've had it then. What he predicted has happened. Because, people talk about Marx and they talk about violent revolution. He never really advocated that, did he?
No, he was fundamentally, he wanted democracy because at the same time, to be able to vote at the time, you had to be a landowner or you had to be a merchant. The access to the vote when Marx was writing was based on if you're a landlord or a capitalist, you could vote. Forget about it if you're working class. So a lot of what Marx called revolution then, we'd call, looking back on it, we'd call democratic reform. And if you read the whole Communist Manifesto as well, a large part of it is a pay into capitalism. It's saying how capitalism has transformed society, and previous social classes were all about maintaining an existing situation. Capitalism and the bourgeoisie are about transforming production, and Marx thought that is a very creative role for capitalism. But what he got wrong, and this is what I focus on, is that his basic principle in the Communist Manifesto and in all his technical writing as well, was that capitalism would divide the world into two classes. There'd be proletariat and bourgeoisie. You'd have a tiny proportion who had wealth and lived off the labor of the majority, and the majority you wouldn't have doctors and nurses and so on. You'd have everybody be reduced to a wage slave. Now, what that got completely wrong was the enormous growth in the middle class, because the apparatus of capitalism, at least for the last 1.5 centuries, has been massively dependent upon a growth of a bureaucracy, both the government bureaucracy, of course, but also bureaucracies inside corporations, which are far larger than the neoclassical myth of perfect competition, and far larger than Marx had in mind as well. And the bureaucracy to run that, rather than getting a division into two social classes, you had an enormous growth of a third social class that wasn't even on Marx's radar, and that was the middle class.
But still this idea of surplus labour, I mean, that was key to it as far as he was concerned. And I wonder whether, so you look at the union movement, for example, was the strength of the union movement really about, well, we want to get some more of that money which is generated by the surplus labour? Or was it more about, well, we just want better conditions because we've been living in bad conditions? Sure, we may want a bit more pay. But, I mean, there's a recognition, isn't there, that, if you've invested in a business, you've got to get some return. You're the one taking the risk. So the money's got to come from somewhere, and that is going to be workers working harder than you're going to pay them for, in effect.
Well, that's what Marx thought. And if you look, just a bit of background here. When I became an academic, it was back in 1987, and I started doing a master's degree at the University of New South Wales. And what I wanted to do in that master's was to take a look at where the labour theory of value came from. Because back when I was an undergraduate student, back at Sydney University in 1973, we did a reading of Das Kapital. This is typical thing a bunch of lefties do in the middle of a Sydney summer, is sit in a darkened room in this main quadrangle of Sydney University, collectively reading every chapter in Das Kapital, Volume 1.
And while everyone else was down at the beach with the girls.
At the beach, yeah. Man, I occasionally hit the beach again. Didn't hit the girls that early, but anyway, I hit the beach every now and then. In reading it, I was sceptical about the labour theory of value, because what the labour theory of value says, apart from saying that, capitalists exploit labour, it was saying that machines provide no net surplus. Machines simply give to production what it costs to make them. And that I just couldn't swallow that. And I remember walking across the campus one day with another young lefty, a lefty lawyer, and we could see all these kangaroo cranes on the buildings in Sydney, because there was a huge building boom going on at the time. I said, I want a really good explanation by Marx as to why those machines aren't adding value. Well, what Marx argued was that before he wrote Capital, he argued that capitalists buy things at their cost of production and sell them at their cost of production. So you buy something what it costs to make it, and you sell it what it costs to make it. So how do you make a profit? And his answer was that when you buy an ordinary commodity, you pay its cost of production, and you get the utility. Whatever if you bought an apple, you pay its cost of production, you get the utility of eating an apple. So with a worker, you pay its cost of production, and the cost of production are the means of subsistence. You've got to pay a worker enough money that they can buy what's necessary to stay alive for that day. But he said the working day, that let's say it takes 6 hours to make what's necessary to keep a worker alive for a full day, worker and worker's family. He said that working day can be 12 hours. So the first 6 hours reproduce the cost, and then the next 6 hours are a surplus that accrues to the employer just because they are the employment contract, and that's where profit comes from.
It's like sweating the assets, isn't it, really? Except the assets are human beings rather than pieces of machinery.
Yeah, well, but he said that doesn't apply to a machine. So if a machine takes, you know, 1,000 hours to make, then it will give 1,000 hours worth of output to the production, but it won't produce any surplus because there's this distinction between labor and labor power, which didn't apply to any other commodity.
But his argument would be that, wouldn't it? That those machines still need people to operate them. So those cranes still have crane drivers, for example.
The
crane driver is getting more results because he's got a crane to help him.
Yeah, but it never made sense. It didn't make sense to me that the machine didn't contribute anything. And when in reading Capital, at the same time, I was revolting against the neoclassical idea about utility maximization and all the subjective theory of value that neoclassicals have. So neoclassical will talk about marginal cost and marginal utility, blah, 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 and I'd already rejected that by the time we started reading Marx. But in the first seven chapters of Capital, Marx starts talking about use value and exchange value. And what he argued was that in a capitalist economy, what matters, what dominates the society, is the exchange value. You make something because you can sell it, not because you want to use it. So the use value of something goes into the background. The foreground of interest in a capitalist system is the exchange value. Use value goes into the background. You said normally that ends up just being something that, you know, you pay for the cost of making a chair. The satisfaction, what you get out of the chair is the fact that you can sit in it. There's no link between the two. They're incommensurable. And when he applied that to labor, he said, well, when you hire a worker, you pay their exchange value, which is their cost of production, which is the means of subsistence. What you get is their use value, which is their capacity to do work for you. They're incommensurable, but this time around, they're both quantitative. One might be 6 hours of labor to make the exchange value. They work for you for 12 hours. That's how you make your profit. And I thought, brilliant argument, absolutely love it, and exactly the same argument applies to machines. The machine costs 1,000 hours of labor to make. It might put the equivalent of 2,000 or 3,000 hours of labor in, and the gap between is a profit. You can make a profit out of both. Now, Marx himself realized this when he first came up with the use value, exchange value stuff, but he buried it in stuff that made it look like the whole, you know, labor, the idea that it was these unique characteristics of labor that explain why I can make a profit. And that was... His new development was right. His old one was wrong. And I think that's really, that's the source of why there was never a socialist revolution.
Well, that sounds like a point at which we could end the podcast, but we don't. We talk for another half an hour or so, including why the fact that there hasn't been a revolution so far doesn't mean that there won't be one in the future for the very reasons that Karl Marx outlined. Perhaps he's just got his timing a bit out. We'll look at why that is in the full version of this podcast. To hear that, you need to subscribe at debunkingeconomics.com or become a supporter of Steve Keen on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/prof Steve Keen. Hopefully you'll do that. We'll see you back here. If not, we'll see you back here for the shortened version of the next one next week. Thanks for listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.